This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2015, held at Faith Builders on August 4 through 7.
Thank you very much for your attention and for your bravery in coming back for a second grilling. So welcome back. I'm just curious, are there any in here today who were not here yesterday? Any here for the first time? Okay, so I did include the resources, so I'll page through them rather quickly. But to get us started here, I will go back to what we closed with yesterday in the things that I would like to cover here this morning, coming up to lunchtime. We're going to look at the steps to effective discipline, proper student-teacher distance in relationships, and then we're going to cover that very uncomfortable situation in what we call remedial discipline. I think if all of us as teachers would have a choice, we'd do without that part. We'd fast forward through it, and we'd get on with the books. But that's not what we're called to. This is a part of teaching just as well as other things are. In my course of preparation, I came across something that really intrigued me, and it's called the 80-15-5 rule. It's a ratio, 80, 15, and 5. I'm a math guy, and so I like numbers, and so I crunched these numbers, and I reduced them to a 16, 3, and 1. Now, what this rule states is that in a class of 20, you'll have 16 that you don't have to worry about. You have one that you want to look out for. And I will say he will identify himself early on. Might, in fact, be she. In between there, we have three. And those three can go either way. They can side up with the one, or they can side up with the 16. Now, not every class of 20 is going to cut down in such fine numbers, but it's something to think about. And I started out with that this morning just to let us realize that most of your class is with you. Most of your class is with you. So I'd like that to encourage you. You're not facing a class of 20 that are out to get you. But you might face one or two. And I've had classes with three or four, it so happens. So keep that in mind as we go on. I'll quickly go through the resources. The COE Classroom Manual, First Days of School by Harry Huang, the Handbook for Creative Teaching. I'm adding a fourth one, however, today that I want you to note, and that is this one. It's a book entitled Effective Classroom Management by Michael Mills. Dr. Mills is currently the assistant professor of teaching and learning in the University of Central Arkansas. Now, the good thing is, in this digital age, is it's a free download on Kindle. So if you use Kindle, you can download this book free. And I found it very, very valuable. With this disclaimer, like Harry Huang, it's a secular book. And I cannot endorse 100% of his methodology. But I found so many valuable things in that book that I thought I would share it with you here and let you be by the Berean, like the Bereans, and really search it out whether the aspects that you're using from that resource are going to be good for you or not. So I present that for what it's worth. In my years in the classroom, and now working with classroom teachers, there's one conclusion that I've made, and that is this. While sometimes we as teachers, and especially to you as newer teachers, we may struggle or even fear a bit about the academics. You know, am I really going to teach algebra? am I going to make it? But I venture to say that beyond that, we struggle with classroom discipline, motivating the students, keeping them on task, keeping them going. And so quickly this morning, we're going to look at six topics. Classroom management, just basically what it is, definition. Positive expectations, procedures and rules, relationships and discipline, preventive discipline, and then remedial discipline. And those Roman numerals will come up later, so you don't need to copy them all down now. That's your preview as we look into the morning's topic. Let's get started then with classroom management. And by definition, classroom management, quoting Harry Wong, is this. It refers to all of the things that a teacher does to organize students. Space, in other words, the classroom space that you have, the time that you have from the time the students come until they leave in the afternoon, as well as your personal time before and after. And it's the materials, the curricula, and everything else that you bring in so that student learning can take place. Notice that under classroom management, it says nothing about teacher plans. It says nothing about teaching a lesson. And while lesson plans are very important, and I trust you're picking that up in other workshops, that's not my assignment. So I'm not looking at that here this morning. I trust you're getting it in other classes. But as we look at discipline and all that is included, it's putting together, classroom management now, is putting together all the resources that can make learning more efficiently and more effective as well. Has a lot to do with procedures and expectations and discipline. And that's where we want to end up at the end of the morning. Let's look now at positive expectations. I begin with a quote from the U.S. Department of Education, quoted by Harry Wong. It says, students tend to learn as little or as much as their teachers expect. We could probably discuss that one for quite a while. Students tend to learn as much or as little as their teachers expect. Teachers who set and communicate high expectations to all their students obtain greater academic performance than teachers who set low expectations. I'd like to tell you a story. Many years ago, when I attended a MAXA convention in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, I sat in a class taught by a man named Bruce Wilkinson. Not Wilkerson, but Wilkinson. He operates an organization called Walk Through the Bible, and I don't know if his name is familiar or not. But as I sat in his class, he related this experience. He told about how one year in the institution where he was teaching, the procedure in that large institution was that they took every grade and they made Group A, Group B, and Group C. Group A was the top, the cream of the crop. Group B was the average students. And Group C was the rest of them. And so in this school, they just felt it was more effective to keep the ones who are grouped similarly in their academic expertise if they kept them together and taught them as a class. So that was their standard practice. One year, the administrators, he told us, did away with the system, and they mixed them all together, but they didn't tell the teachers. And so the teachers that year went ahead and they taught Group A, they taught Group B, and they taught Group C. And guess what? Group A did a lot better than Group B and Group C. At the end of the year, the administrator told the teachers what he had done, and they couldn't believe it. They went back to their grade books. They said, well, their essays were better, their research papers were better, their grades were better. We can prove it by our books. The only difference was the expectation of the teachers. Now, you can only take that to a certain degree, but think about it. The expectation of those teachers made a difference. And so I bring it to you today. Why did that A group perform better? Because they were expected to do better. And so the expectation raised them to a higher level. The bottom line here is that positive expectations do make a difference. They do make a difference. Quoting now from Dr. Mills, in 1972, he coined a new word called the warm defenders. Demanders. The warm demanders. Now, the warm demanders describes a style of teaching where teachers combined a personal interest in students while holding them to a high standard of expectations. There we get the warm and we get the demanders. I'll come back to that a little later after this clarification. Let's make sure, however, that we understand the difference between high expectations and high standards. We can too easily raise the bar of high standards too high. For example, expecting your entire class to come out as straight A students. That's setting the standard too high. You can still have high expectations. And the high expectations for some students might be to be a B student, to be a C student, if that's the best that that child can do. That is still having a high positive expectation of what that child can do. But don't make the mistake of thinking that everyone is going to be able to make an A average or even a straight A or A plus. Just the difference there between the high standard and high expectations. Back to the warm defender. The warm demander. In being a warm demander, first of all, takes a very warm personal relationship. Building a relationship. And I'm going to capitalize on that as we go through this morning. Relationships between you and your student rather than being cold. The demander part then is what we expect. And the expectations went something like this. They expected them, first of all, to complete all assignments, to actively participate in class, and to work hard and do their best, and treat others with respect. Those four things. And we can expect those in our schools as well, that our students do those four things. We are not asking too much of them. We are not demanding too much of them if we ask them to do those four things. To make sure they do their work by completing all assignments, that they actively participate in the class, that they work hard, do their best, and treat others with respect. Students place a high value on having teachers who are warm. Teachers who care. Teachers who care not just about their academics, but also their personal life, taking the whole package. Around the end of 2002, Corbett and Wilson came up with this, and they did a survey. They interviewed 400 students. Now, these 400 students were not your students or mine. They were inner city public school students. And this is what they found. These students were expecting this of their teachers. And I believe your students will expect it of you as well. They expected them to make them work. Now, if you ask a student that to their face, they probably wouldn't admit that right away, would they? But deep down inside, they want to work. They want you to control the classroom so that they can work. They want you to be willing to help them whenever and however they need help. They want you to explain their assignments clearly and the content clearly. They want you to vary classroom routine some of the time, but don't mix it up so much that they become uneasy. There's a certain safety and security in routine, and they will expect that of you as well. And they want teachers who took time to know them and their personal preferences. While I'm looking at the positive expectations, I must also be fair that there is a negative side. And so I share the negative side to tell you what to stay away from. For example, students should never hear comments like these. And yet some students in your classes may have heard this from their parents, from their peers. Would to God they never hear it from us. Things like, you're too stupid. Why can't you be like your older brother or sister or cousin or so-and-so in the class? You'll never learn. You'll never amount to anything. You're no good. You're wasting my time. And you know, just as students will come up to your positive expectations, they will also meet negative expectations. And so if they are made to feel that they can't, guess what? They won't. It's about as simple as that. They give up trying. They'll give up trying. Now, you may never have said anything like that, but let's be very careful, especially as new teachers, to realize that students can read us. And while we may not say it, sometimes our mannerisms, our body language, how we react to their questions, how we respond, may tell them, without words, some of these negative expectations, and they will meet them every time. I'd like to talk about procedures and rules. But I'd like to make one thing very clear here. Before you write a lot of rules and procedures for your class, go to the school where you're teaching and ask the principal, the board chairman, last year's teachers, what are the procedures in this school? In other words, don't reinvent the wheel. Especially as a first-time teacher, go with what they had. And so, for our sake this morning, we'll be covering more what to do with existing procedures and rules rather than what you might want to write as rules. Some schools allow some variation from room to room. That's okay, if that's the school culture, from teacher to teacher. But as a newer teacher, it's much better that you go with what they have than trying to make up your own. Spend your first few years fitting into their system as you find a pattern then that will work for you, a pattern that fits your personality, a pattern that helps you relate in your responsibility to those students. Also keep in mind that the procedures that a first grade teacher has will be very different from what a high school teacher has. And so you'll need to accommodate for the age of your students. And that's true in all of discipline. It varies very greatly from age to age and class to class. I'd like to look then at some steps in classroom procedures. your first few weeks of school, it's more important that you spend time with procedures than it is that you get all your academics taught. And so, however long it may take, let's get the procedures down pat. And I'll look at some of those. First thing is, you need to communicate to your students what you expect of them. What are the procedures that will follow in this classroom? And again, this will vary according to age, but especially for first, second, third grade, the younger students, you will need to model some of these. Model how you want them to do this activity or that activity. So first you tell them, and next you show them. First you tell them, next you show them. Number three, then, you will have them do it. Have them practice. For example, if you have them line up at the door to come into the classroom and they come in an unorderly way, back them up and try it again. So tell them, show them, and have them do it repeatedly until it sticks. And that's number four. You keep monitoring and repeating as needed throughout the week, especially the first week. Hopefully you won't have to go into the second week that way, but there's a possibility you might in some of the activities that you will be doing. The best managed classrooms have been proven to be those who spend their first few weeks making sure that the procedures are well understood and well practiced. It's just setting the tone for those for the whole year, for that matter. I'd like to look at some of the procedures. I mentioned entering the classroom. Have something productive for them to do when they come. Maybe something on their desk, something up on the board, something that you want them to be doing in those first minutes as they come into your classroom. Have it well stated what they may and what they may not do after that bell rings. If you begin the day with a warning bell or something, what may they yet do in the 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever you have between a first and second bell? Make sure that's clear, what they may or may not do during that time. For example, our school in West Virginia begins at 8:30 in the morning, but we ring our first bell at 8:25. And you might say, that's not fair. Their school doesn't start till 8:30. Well, at 8:25 is the warning bell, and there are things that they may and may not do. Usually, if you're around there, they'll be filling up water bottles at the fountain. They'll still be going to the restroom, etc., sharpening pencils, etc. And at 8:30, they're ready to go. Now, do a little math. Again, I like math, but if it takes them to 8:35 every morning to get settled in and you get started, you lose 5 minutes every morning, times the number of students you have, times the number of days. So how many minutes are lost just by not getting them on task right away in the first part there? And the same thing is true coming in from recess, coming back from lunch, anytime they have an out-of-class activity. How effectively and efficiently they come back in ready for task right away will save you a lot of teaching time throughout the year. So that procedure can go a long way. Now, they come into the classroom. There's also a right and a wrong way of leaving the classroom. I don't know how many of you have an automatic bell system, but I won't say much about this other than to say that the bell is not meant for the student. The bell is for you. Do not allow students to just up and run when the bell rings. Now, you try, though, to prepare ahead of time to be ready to dismiss them when there's a bell, because guaranteed when that bell rings, they're done. They shut off. So you try to anticipate when that bell is going to ring so that you are ready then to give them the signal. But the bell should not be used to dismiss them. It's only your signal then for you to dismiss them. Going to the restroom, and again, age is a big difference here. For many years, I used a restroom pass. It hung on the chalkboard right behind my desk. One for the boys, one for the girls. That made sure that there wasn't more than one of each going to the restroom at any given time. Now, depending on the size of your school, you may even just use one. Depending on the size of your class, that way there's only one out. Now, I don't know what you're going to use for a pass, but make sure you make it big enough that they don't stick it in their pocket and forget about it. I read of one school that actually, you know, hangs something around their neck with the pass. Now, I think that could kind of get in the way of some bathroom activities. One school actually had them wear a safety vest, you know, those bright green fluorescent neon colors, you know. In other words, when that child went to the bathroom and was out in the halls, again, depending on the size of your school, everyone knew what they were about. And if they were anywhere else in the building, they knew they were off limits. So be creative. Come up with something that you can use there that will be good. Also in the middle and upper grades especially, be very aware of gender issues. I used the honor system with the pass. I didn't want my high school girls to need to ask me to go to the restroom, and you understand why. And so I used the honor system with the pass. It just made it a lot easier for me and for them. How do they get your attention? And I'm talking about attention in a positive way. Some students will get your attention in a negative way. But how do they get their attention? Do they raise their hand? Do they have hand signals? There's various things you can do. And again, I'm not setting these procedures for your schools. Find out what is being used and whether it's being used effectively. I like signals other than hand signals because, you know, you have that child that when his hand's up and he's waving it and he's distracting other students and he's not on task. And so if you can have some kind of a signal, whether it's a flag you use or in visiting schools, I pick up some of these ideas. One school had a wooden cube, and you can get them at craft stores or a pyramid or something like that, painted different colors on the different sides, and then the student would flip up which side facing you in the front, what their particular need was at that point. So some way of communicating with you, and while that block is sitting there, that student should be on task with their work, doing something else. Try to tell your students, train your students, that even while they're waiting for a response from you, that they go on to something else. Some students waste so much time waiting for the teacher, and especially if they're sitting there waving their hands. And the longer that you wait to come, the more frantic their hand movements. And so try to avoid that if you can. In some way. Collecting papers. If you always have the same procedure, it's a lot simpler. Now, here, there wouldn't be a problem. We would just go across, wouldn't we? Usually our classes are in rows, but I would still recommend you pass papers across rather than up back to front. My reason for that is when you're passing papers from back to front, there's a lot of poking and nudging and, you know, over the shoulder type things, where if you go from side to side, there's a lot less of that activity needed among that. Now, you can have them all go from one side to the other and then up from there, or you can place yourself along that outer aisle and just come up through and collect the papers as you go. Here's a big one: recess and breaks. Deciding what to do for recess and breaks. Have a system. for having them decide, or you decide, what's going to be done at recess. Have a teacher on duty on the playground. I find that very, very important. Have the teachers take turns, have a schedule, a rotation of what you will be doing. And you can give the students some autonomy in this, have them choose, but if you have a student assigned to plan the recess, give them maybe some time before recess so that when the recess time comes that you're ready to go. There's a lot of not only time wasted as they try to decide what to play, as it's just a disorganized time that can just bring a lot of unrest and a lot of opportunities for doing things that you don't want them to be doing. Then there's a lot of miscellaneous things, pencil sharpening, getting a drink. We like if our students bring their own paper hankies and have a box right with them. Try to cut down classroom traffic as much as possible. Let's talk about relationships. What part do relationships play in discipline? I'm going to go into the COE training manual for the next thing. First of all, this I think came from Dr. Mills. In a research done in 2002, with over 100 studies done, it was concluded that positive teacher-student relationships were fundamental in classroom management. Now that's a given. Further, they found that positive relationships reduce behavioral problems by 31%. Now, I would venture that in our Christian schools that number is a lot higher. I would hope so, that it would reduce behavior problems by more than 31%. Back in the 70s, there was a study done with 4,000 teenagers in finding out what type of a relationship they had with their parents. Because of that relationship, and it was done with parents, and I'm going to apply it to teachers, they came up with four different groups, four different styles. There was the neglectful parent, who is low in discipline and low in love. Now, I would say of the four, this one probably will not affect you as much. I don't think any of our teachers are going to err on the side of being neglectful. I would surely hope not. So we can kind of scratch that one. What neglectful parents do is they flee responsibility. They're not involved in their children's lives. And they either don't care or they're just too busy to get involved. The next one is the permissive parents. And the permissive parent is low in discipline and high in love. I have an embarrassing story about myself. I was involved as a teenager in an inner city mission in Westchester, Pennsylvania, teaching summer Bible school. And I was teaching about fifth grade boys. And I was determined to go into that Bible school and leaving there that they would really like me. And so I was lax in discipline to try and get them to like me. Now, you teachers might have that temptation. I'm warning you, don't fall for it. I'll go on from there. The permissive parents are low in discipline, high in love, in quotes. They fear their children, and they let them have free rein. The authoritarian parents are low in love and high in discipline. This is the drill sergeant type. You do this or else. Low in love, high in discipline. They fight their children and harshly enforce obedience. Sadly, in that survey, it revealed that 80% of those families were in that group. 80% of the families interviewed. Now, I trust that we won't have 80% of our schools in that category. The fourth category is the one we all want to have as our goal, and that is high degrees of both love and discipline. This group reveals that relationships play a very major part in our relating to our students. Now, in looking at these four, but maybe the three, if, especially as new teachers, if any of us err on either side, it will be that we'll either be permissive or we'll err on the side of authoritarian. Now, I can go into a classroom where there's an authoritarian teacher, and at first glance, it looks like an ideal classroom. Everyone is working, it's quiet, things are just... But after a while, you get the feeling that there's a tenseness. They're not relaxed. They're not on task because they want to be, but there's fear. I can also walk into visiting a classroom where there's a permissive teacher, and my, it's a mess. So somewhere in between there is your goal. We want to be authoritative. We want to be high in discipline, but we want to do it with a loving, caring relationship. We want to be the warm demanders and work with them from that. Now, why do I talk about parents when I'm talking to teachers? It's been proven that teachers who have a loving, authoritative relationship with their students will achieve the best results in the classroom and have the best relationship and impact in their students' lives. So make that as your goal, to be authoritative in what you're doing. That clock's going faster than we are. We must move on. Let's look at physical relationships. Unfortunately, we live in a time when physical touch and closeness seems to be taboo. The world has so twisted these ideas that even at times in a Christian school, we must be careful. So in your teacher-to-student relationships, how do we model purity to our students? And again, age makes a big difference. You first, second, third grade teachers, you got it made in this. They will lap up everything that you can bring to them. But to you middle and upper grade teachers, be very, very careful. Be very cautious. These children and youth, adolescents and youth, are battling with emotions that they don't understand. And it's sad when it happens, but I've heard of students getting a crush on their teacher. And sometimes the teacher's not aware of what's happening. Unfortunately, sometimes the teacher is feeding it. And these are very, very unhealthy circumstances when there's an unhealthy attachment to a teacher. This is especially true if there's an unhealthy home situation. So beware of that. In working at a student's desk, be very careful about bodily contact. Watch where you place your hands in relation to theirs. We had an experience many years ago with a middle school teacher, a man teacher, and it was with a seventh or eighth grade boy. There seemed to be a wall building up, and he discovered that the young man felt he was too close, too much physical touch. So be careful of that. And especially be careful and avoid cross-gender touching and counseling of older students. I make a rule, if at all possible, physically, to have some glass in every classroom door, and especially the school office. I don't like to be behind a closed door. Keep that open. We must go on into preventive discipline, and I need to go through this rather quickly. One of the best things is to keep students excited about learning. Keep an interest. Curiosity and wonders are great motivators. A curious student is rarely a misbehaving student. And so keep them excited about that. I think yesterday we talked about success and achievement. Now, with older students, once you can direct their attention to serving the Lord, a lot of these other things will go away. They will desire to please you. When you have a love for the student, they will desire to please you. Students have basically five, all of us for that matter, five basic needs. We all want to be accepted. We all want attention, whether positive or negative. We all want appreciation. We all want affirmation, and we all want affection. Whether or not they receive those five will go a long ways in their behavior. If their tank is empty on any of those five, they will become that minority in your class that is wanting some kind of attention. Acceptance, attention, appreciation, affirmation, and affection. Let's go on now with preventive. Using body language, just your position in the class. Move around in the class, even while you're lecturing. Just walking up in front of a student who's misbehaving and maybe pausing a bit, you can get their attention. You can make eye contact, lip movement, lifting or shaking a finger, just using your body in ways like that. I want to close then with some remedial discipline ideas. The most important rule here is find out what is expected of you in your school. What is expected? What may I or may I not do? What am I expected to do? Always work with the administration and then find out if corporal punishment is allowed or not, or is expected or not. We're at various places in this in our schools. I'm aware of that. So you need to find out early on what is expected and what is not accepted. Let's look yet at some general guidelines and principles. Establish order early. B, have loving control right from the start. Build relationships. Good, solid relationships will go a long way. Seek the support of parents as well as administration. You are not in this alone. If you are, you've got problems. If your parents will not support you, there are problems. So seek their support. Seek their help. Discipline for the child's good. The focus of discipline can be both positive and negative, but it should be what we do for the student rather than what we do to the student. Use God's principles. God disciplines in love, with mercy, and for our good. Wrong behavior is most often a result of choices, wrong choices. Stop inappropriate actions at once. You may not do the discipline, but at least get Johnny to stop doing what he's doing. Just call his name or stand in front of him or something. And there are times when we must rebuke publicly. I don't like to discipline publicly, but a public rebuke for a public infraction, I believe, is effective. It does two things. First of all, they know that you saw what happened. And secondly, the rest of the class knows that you know and that you're working on it. So that goes together very well. Consider the circumstances. Discuss why they need discipline. In closing, yet, let us ask these questions. Were my instructions clear? Did the student understand? Is he being rebellious or just merely childish? Is he challenging my authority or just being irresponsible? Try to discern this. Is he reacting to me personally? Have I offended or wounded his spirit? I had one occasion where I really offended a young man, and a wall went up between us until I found out what it was and confessed it to him after he was brave enough to tell me what it was. The wall started coming down. Have I been inconsistent? And for beginning teachers, this is a tough one. do be consistent. Don't let them get by with one thing one day and punish him for it the next day. Be consistent. Have I reflected a negative attitude? Is it a spiritual problem? Are there poor relationships at home? Does he have a wrong attitude? And is there peer pressure? Now, again, I'm not going to go into how you should punish. I want you to go back to your school and ask them, what is acceptable, what is not? Because if you go in and start doing things that have not fit that school culture, there's going to be some problems. In closing, I'd like to close with just one word, and that is the word consistency. Be consistent. Build a good relationship and be consistent and follow it through to the end. Thank you very much. You've been a very good audience these days. God bless you as you go into the classroom. Again, you first-year teachers, I know you're trembling in your shoes, but you'll get over it. Trembling is not all bad. I want you to keep trembling, because if you don't, that means that you're doing it in your own strength and your own power. So God bless you in that. Just a final word as I sit down. I'll be in room 107 after lunch till 1:30. Due to other schedules, I need to leave. If you have any COE questions yet, come see me over lunchtime. Thank you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.